Hello, everyone. My name is Devin Rue. I'm a professional fantasy cartographer and illustrator in the tabletop RPG industry, as well as your host for the Quip and Quill podcast.
My name is Jonah Loeb. I am an artist who's been working in the fantasy realm for about 20 years now. I used to work in games. I worked for Bethesda Softworks for 7 years. I worked on games like Oblivion, The Shivering Isles, Fallout 3, Skyrim, and Fallout 4. And then in the interim, I've been working on a bunch of random freelance gigs, living the freelance life here in New York. I wrote a book that never got published. I worked on a game that never got made. And I am currently doing most of my focus on YouTube and on trying to kind of push educational and inspirational videos about creativity and art and fantasy and world building in that direction. And my most recent published work is called Marvel Anatomy, and it's basically a big tome of anatomical and physiological information about kind of the Marvel characters in the Marvel universe, and that came out about a year ago.
I have been seeing your posts on it. I am so fascinated with this idea.
It was honestly really fun. I am not somebody who traditionally has been a big Marvel fan. Not because I don't like heroes per se, but because Marvel itself is such a long kind of canonized world. And I didn't see a lot of space in that world for kind of an original creator and somebody who wants to create original content, because everything is kind of belongs to the stories and the writers and all that, and the characters. But when I was introduced to the project, it was so novel and so weird for me to draw the insides of superheroes. And I recognized right away that this was an unprecedented chance for me to create canon en masse and actually really just have a personal impact on these stories. And so, yeah, I spent a year and a half working on the project, and it was very challenging and really fun. And I'm quite proud of the result.
Yeah, no, I love it, but I'm also I'm one of those people who loves like the botany sketches and everything else.
Well, so, you're somebody who you love detail and yes. You know, and exact little lines and in little information, you know. Yeah.
I want the science behind everything.
exactly. And trying to reverse engineer how fantasy works is fun. You know, if people are willing to play that game, you can go deep, you know? And I think it's a brilliant way to engage the mind. And I think even to engage like young people, you know, when I think back to what it was like being young, flipping through, you know, visual glossaries of ancient Rome and things like that, you know, these discovery books, you absorb so much information in such a fun way. And I think that, Marvel Anatomy is really fun at bringing people into the idea of just playing games and trying to figure out, well, if this, then how does that work? And if that works that way, what does this look like? That kind of thing.
It kind of reminded me of the Mallrats scene where they're talking about Lois Lane and Superman having sex.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Let's game this out. You know, let's really figure out, like, you know, like, yes, it's nice that vampires glitter in the sunlight, but like what really goes on when they bite you? And, you know, that let's. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of, I think lore is really fun to play with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I have to ask, why do you have a book that was written but never published?
Well, I just couldn't find a major publisher. I found a great agent. I spent 3 years working on a fantasy book. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of the reasons I left Bethesda, actually, because they had a stipulation in the contract that anything you worked on whilst working at Bethesda could potentially be theirs. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons I left was to write this. I spent 3 years writing this fantasy novel. I got a great book agent here in New York who I loved. She was fantastic, but she couldn't find a home with any of the major publishers, and ultimately I had to kind of give up on that hunt. And she actually gave up on being a book agent. She moved on to a completely different profession.
Why not? Well, okay, so I'm gonna for the younger people in our audience, way back when which is basically 10 years ago, if that, self-publishing was not really a thing you wanted to do. It basically meant your book would never be picked up, nobody would see it, and you are the sole responsible person for trying to get it out in the world. But now that that has changed grossly, because I too am starting to like wanting to write. Well, I've written lots of stuff over the years, and bits and pieces have been published in like articles and stuff. But I finally like am getting back to writing full on stories. And I am now really fascinated with wanting to self-publish, because I think that that's far better. I shouldn't say that, because if you can get with a publisher and everything else and they take care of all that stuff for you, fantastic. But it's really hard.
It's very hard. It's really hard. And I don't think, you know, you use a phrase like they take care of you. I don't think they really can take care of you.
No.
My impression and my understanding thus far is there's actually just not that much money in books right now. I think I think having the keys to a particular kingdom of, you know, a particular world can be enormously valuable. So, for instance, the Harry Potter world, the Elder Scrolls kind of franchise. If you can have that, then you can build, you know, so many different things from that. But simply trying to sell a book. It's just not a lot of money in that.
No. And then, Would you consider doing it for yourself? I mean, just self-publishing?
Well, it's so funny that you asked that, Devin, because yes, I'm actually working on a project right now, which we don't have to talk about now. We can talk about later.
It's up to you.
But it's called Quiet Level One. It's a comic book, and it's me kind of launching my own world. And it's nice. It's a story about a little cute little skeleton who he can't speak, he's mute, and how he has to defend the Tree of Worlds against the unstoppable villain human warrior Galahorn. And so I am going to bring that to Kickstarter. My aim is April.
Nice.
So this is me giving the masses a go, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I want to. I'm trying to decide how I want to release my stories, because I kind of don't like. All right, so I have a couple of authors that I love, but they're like a tremendous amount of time. One of them is 15 years between books.
Oh my goodness! Are we talking about Kingkiller at this point?
It's the writer who wrote Clan of the Cave Bear.
Oh yeah, that's currently sitting on my desk. I haven't gotten very far on it, but it's like
Oh, wow. Okay. It's a difficult read, but she's got a lot of information, which I just devoured her books. But it's like 10 years between her books, 15 years, and I'm like, I can't wait that long. You know, like
that's so long.
Right, I'm 50 now. Like, you know, seriously, I don't have that long. No, just kidding.
Also, how old is she? She must be getting up there.
I honestly don't know. I'm really bad. I'm like the worst kind of fan of anything in the world. I only care about the material. Oh, I never look up the artists or anything. Oh, which is horrible, because I am an artist. I should be better, but I don't think about it. I just want to devour the story.
I mean, you know, but that's also part of the wonder of it all is the idea of the story living on past the author, you know? The story, you know, once the story is getting released, now it belongs to the world, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out how I want to, release the stories, whether or not I want to do a full-on book and release that, you know, with every time that I do that, or I definitely want to release the world that one of the stories takes part in. Mm-hmm. Because all of them kind of take part in the same world, and excuse me, because I love stories that connect with each other or give a different perspective of the same exact story. Well, not exact story, obviously, but you know, I love when you can get a good book that tells you from the hero's perspective, and then you find out, like, you know, they're fighting the evil villain, and you find out the villain's perspective is totally not what you thought.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
I love that. Because so, that also feels so real too. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it feels like the world is very much alive when you find out that there's other people that are affected and you get to hear their stories. You know, like I forgot the creator's name, but he was talking about Godzilla, and he was like, oh yeah, you know, there's all of, you know, we see the great battle between Godzilla and King Kong. He's like, but all of the hundreds of people that died because they're knocking into buildings in Manhattan and all this stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I never would have thought about how Godzilla would not really be the hero.
No.
To any of those people.
No way.
I know he saved the planet, but he also wiped out entire families. Oh shit, yeah, you know. And that changed my perspective. A lot of books that I had read prior to that. So I wanna release something that feels so. I'm debating on whether just releasing it as I write them. I mean, obviously with beta readers and an editor. Not as I'm writing it, because that's pretty horrible.
That sounds really tough. Yeah. But I do think there's an argument to be made for releasing things as you go and showing your work, because I think that's kind of how you can really bring an audience forward and get some, you know, I think, you know, to use Critical Role as an example, they did not have everything in order when they started just broadcasting. You know,
oh, hell no.
Yeah, no, it was kind of a mess, and the mics were terrible and the cameras were terrible and it was cramped and weird. But it was what people needed to kind of get hooked, you know? So I definitely think that releasing things in smaller morsels is also makes it easier for you, you know?
That's one of the reasons why I actually do on my Discord. I have all of my beta readers are in a channel that I get to release bits and pieces to them and kind of like get feedback, and it feels more organic, but it also feels more collaborative as well, and I love that.
Absolutely. In my working, sorry, you might hear a ambulance in the background. We're in New York, folks.
I know, right? I'm surprised I haven't heard it the entire time.
Yeah, okay. It's just past my window. Okay, great. I've started, as I've been working on Quiet Level 1 in the last couple months, I've started a Substack, which is basically, for anyone who doesn't know, it's basically just a blog and newsletter combined, so that I can write articles and they can show up in your email, but you can also go online and look through them, etc. But basically just cataloging my progress, explaining my thought process, that kind of thing. It's very helpful for me to help me crystallize things and articulate things in my mind. And then I think it's just really good for the audience, who get to feel much more involved and who get to comment and say whatever they want. And I feel like you're cultivating investment, you know, and you're cultivating people to be on your team.
Oh yeah. Our sponsor for the podcast is Legend Keeper. And I started using it for something for my players, but now I'm like, well, if I'm building the world the way that I'm planning or releasing it that way, I think it's a great way to kind of do this thing, to put bits and pieces out there. Because what I love is people who devour lore the way I do and notice inconsistencies that as a writer you don't see, because your brain just wants to keep going through like what's story, and then you forget details or whatever because you're just too excited to get a particular part out. They remember everything. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll just start putting it all in Legend Keeper and build the world out that way. And I just love this idea of creating it in front of people.
It sounds really cool. I'm looking it up now. This seems like a really cool thing, like a great way of building.
Oh, yeah. So again, the reason that they became the sponsor is because I talk about them so much, because when I discovered the tool, my DM sent me a link to his world that he had built on it. And I was like, what is this? You know, and I started learning about how it's such a simple program. It's like writing in a Word document, but at least everything links up super easily. As you're writing the text, it'll highlight if you have some name the same thing.
Oh,
right. So like, let's say every time that you mention a character's name, it'll have a link. So you can just go to that page and have like their stats, or I don't know, have their picture or whatever you want to do. And I love this idea.
And I've been just keeping a Google Doc. And now, like,
oh yeah. And you can create timelines on it. You create storyboards on it. Like there are so many really neat tools on it to just find a much easier way to stay organized, which is super helpful. Oh, I find the site such a lifesaver. So when I started talking about it so much and kept making the joke they should support the podcast, so they did. Sorry, listeners, yet again, Mike is going to be fucking weird.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. This is what happens. It's just also we're having an ice storm here in Oregon.
Oh, I wonder if that's what's going on.
Yeah. So my internet may be a wee bit choppy. We are trying to figure out how so we moved into a house that's like 100 years old. And so obviously everything was put in afterwards, things like cable and internet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to figure out what bazillion internet cables actually work or don't in this house so I can hook my computer up. But you know, now we have to suffer.
We'll make it work. We'll make it work. Right. We'll fix it in post.
Yes.
We'll have the bot just replace all the words.
Right? I don't, it's not AI, thank God.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, this is true. God. I don't think any AI would be able to duplicate the conversations I've had. But it would be interesting if they could. How close could they get? I don't want to find out.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I think everyone's pretty much used to the shitty quality of my podcast.
Oh no.
This is literally an excuse to hang out and talk to people I either admire, have worked with, or want to spend time getting to know.
I love it. It's perfect. I wish more of like our artist friends had podcasts. And like,
great.
I've tried to sometimes initiate, like, hey, you want to do like a Zoom call, Zoom hangout? Some people say yes. Some people are like, I don't know, I'm scared.
Right.
Which is fine. Which is like totally fine. But it is, yeah. Yeah, any excuse.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is, like, we're horrible. If it's not work-related, we won't do it.
No.
Right.
No. Right. Who's got time?
Right. Like, I had a Discord with a bunch of artists on it. Unless there was a reason for us to talk, like, we would occasionally post things on it, but that was about it. You know, like, we're all like, I don't have time to sit in a voice call.
Mm-mm.
I'm like, I tried though. And so I was like, fuck it, I'll do a podcast. And it wasn't even supposed to be this. It was supposed to be me coming on, talking about world building and occasionally having guests on. And then I had a single conversation with Aaron Radney that I was like, nope, it's turning into this now. So
you definitely have to like follow like what naturally it wants to be, yes. You know, and like that's where you're gonna get the best. That's where you're gonna get the best juice for the squeeze for sure. And you know, there's when we're surrounded, we live in an age where we're surrounded by amazing artists and world builders and storytellers and creatives. There's so much knowledge to be gleaned, you know, from outside sources. So yeah, any excuse you can have to bring them on, like it's I think it's the right call.
Oh yeah, and as somebody who's, although I, as far as being in the gaming industry goes, my actual other traditional art was the long way around, so to speak, so I fully understand how hard it is to get into doing this for a living, but I feel really bad for how many people have no idea what they're getting into, whether it's the gaming industry or just general whatever. But there's, when you go to college for it, it doesn't prepare you for what you have to do as an artist to make it as a freelancer At best, it might prepare you a little bit for working for a company, but not how to get those jobs.
No, I agree. Yeah. I get approached by a lot of people on social media asking me how they get their start in this or that. There's just so many of them, you know, so many young people who just, they don't know the roadmap, but they know they just have passion and they have ideas and,
right.
You know, helping them figure out the best venue, let alone the best, you know, like industry, you know, it's a journey and everyone's path is different. And I think that we sometimes think we know what we want, and what we want actually is something a little bit different.
Yes.
And so trying to get at the heart of what it is that drives you, I think, is so key. You know, For me, I know that, you know, I've always liked telling stories. I used to love writing in middle school and in high school and even in college. But I've just always loved it. But I figured as an artist, you know, my primary job was being an artist. And now it really has turned into like world building, storytelling, and, you know, using art as the main vessel for that. But it's these larger aspects, the desire to tell, you know, even in creating character art for Skyrim, I was trying to tell stories with the characters and creatures. And I realized that's, you know, it's people, it's animals, it's creatures, it's living things that I want to tell stories about.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I got into cartography, and oddly enough, because I made a map of Skyrim.
I was just looking at some work of yours, and I just saw it, and I love it. I love it so much. It's so good.
Yeah, I had already been, like I said, I've been doing art since I was a teenager, and like everyone else, you have to have like a regular time job to be a freelancer, because it's really hard to find the enough that you can do it freelance full. But I ended up making a map of Skyrim because I got the game, and I'm absolutely a huge Elder Scrolls fan. I've been playing Battlespire.
Nice. A true fan.
Or just that old. But I love it, and we got the game, and it came with a map, and I was like, this doesn't look like the map you see in the game. This doesn't even look like the map you teleport with.
It's beautiful work.
Thank you.
You have incredible discipline and patience, and that's like so much of what's required to do amazing art. And it's brilliant.
Oh yeah, but art is the only thing I have that kind of patience. I spend it all there, and then outside of that, not as much. Well, maybe writing.
Yeah.
But that's still art, so yeah, not quite the same.
I worked on some of these biggest titles ever, and I don't have much financially to show for it.
Right. There is no one job that'll ever set you for life.
No, but if there is one, I'm doing my best to get there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. If you find it before me, please let me know. If I find it you, I absolutely will probably keep it to myself because I need the job.
I appreciate your candor. I appreciate it. Yeah. Happy hunting. Let the games begin.
Oh God. Did you have to say it like it's the Hunger Games? Oh wait, it is. Oh God.
It is. It is. They don't say starving artists for no reason.
Right? Oh, we say that almost every episode we mention starving. Because even if, like, so I've talked about this, but you know, we get at times we get these huge gigs. I've done work for Wizards of the Coast, where I've done like all the maps in Wildemount, which was like 16 maps or something.
Wow.
Right. So that was a beautiful payday, but it was nowhere near enough like me to live on, much less beyond that. So, you know, and it's, you don't get paid immediately after doing it. It's not like a paycheck, win and get something every 2 weeks or whatever. It takes anywhere from 60 to 90 days easily, or longer depending on the company, for you to get paid.
Yeah.
So yeah. And that's after it's been approved, not even after you've started. So yeah. If your project takes you a month to do, and then it takes them 2 weeks to approve, and then you send in your invoice, it's 60 days or 90 days from approval of the invoice. You can't live that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Trust me. I know, man. I know.
It's really, yeah.
Yeah. Hey.
I know, you know, but there's a lot of people who don't understand. Like, I've been asked, like, you know, oh, you work with Crystal or you work with Wizards or Magic the Gathering. Why do you have a Patreon? Because none of them are a steady paycheck. I can't count the, I don't know exactly when I'll get paid for any of this. And I don't work consistently enough that it would be like a paycheck.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the tricky part. You know, you can't ever sit and rest. You just got to keep creating and keep building. Yeah. I don't know what to do.
Do you have a Patreon?
You know, I had one up until about 3 weeks ago. And I got rid of it in favor of Substack. Mostly because I just couldn't find the time in the week to contribute to Patreon. And, mm-hmm. You know, I'm just, especially with working on Quiet Level 1, as much as I am, for a while I was posting about it there. And then I just felt like, why am I trying to create something for the masses that, but I'm only letting a select few people who can toss me a few bones in on the process and on the secrets. That's kind of counterproductive. And it just felt like also at the same time, when I was asking people to pay, you know, a month, and I'm not able to give them anything. Well, that makes me feel really bad about myself.
Right.
And so, you know, I feel guilty. Like, these wonderful people, you know, want to support me, but I'm not, like, you know, it's not like a quid pro quo per se. You know, a lot of it is just they want to support me, but it's really hard. I found it really hard to, after a while, to take that money. And so I finally just said, you know what, I am stopping this. I'm moving over to Substack, which is free. If you want to throw me a couple dollars, I would not say no, and I appreciate that very much. But, like, honestly, I'm trying to build awareness, and I'm trying to build a large audience, and I'm trying to also, you know, just be able to reach people where they're at. And so having something that doesn't have any kind of wall between me and the audience, I think was preferable. And so, and I wasn't really earning that much on Patreon. It wasn't, living in New York, it doesn't pay the bills. And yeah. You know, the harsh realities of the world with regards to finances just can't stand up. You know, weren't making Patreon worth my while. I'm sure that if I had put more into it, I would have continued to see more growth.
Right.
But it felt weird then trying to work for a small number of people. I don't know. It felt weird. So anyway, I'm on Substack now, and I really enjoy it because I just write these little 3-minute articles, and I release them once a week on Saturday morning, and they show up in people's inbox, and it's just a way for me to, and I can talk about whatever I want, and I don't have to worry about whether I'm giving them something more than just a quick story, a quick tale. I was on it for a while, but I'm not anymore.
Yeah, this makes me want to check out Substack just out of curiosity. I don't I don't think that Patreon is for everybody. I think it really does depend on your work model, which is another thing that's really hard to kind of describe to people, you know, because I get a lot of people who ask me for advice on getting started or what they should do or what they should do for Patreon. Patreon doesn't work for everybody. It does feel like you should be producing work for everybody monthly. And sometimes that just can't be.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So I completely understand.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where I'm at. And I'm pretty happy with the results so far. And I appreciate people who are throwing me money, and I don't, you know, count on it, but it's really nice. It's just nice to have that kind of support. But, you know, because it already wasn't contributing that much to my pocketbook, I just felt like, let's just drop it. Let's move on. Let's do something else. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, if it works for you, fucking absolutely. Also, like, how mind-blowing is it at times to think about the fact that you have worked on one of, like, the biggest games, and yet you still have to really build a following?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's. I'm so grateful to have gotten to work on some of these biggest games. I mean, really, they formed the bedrock of my career, like without a doubt. But I've had to put a tremendous amount of energy into kind of attaching my name to that title, those titles, because especially while I was there, they were very jealous about, you know, they didn't want anybody talking to the press or uploading their portfolios to any art websites. I couldn't show my ZBrush work on the ZBrush website. You know, I wasn't really allowed to, you know, just because they wanted to control everything. And so what it meant was that all the things that I did, all of the credit to that, you know, just bypassed me entirely and went directly to Bethesda, the entity, and the people who are at the top. And, you know, I think there are understandable reasons why they might operate that way, but it did not work for me. And it made it really hard, you know, to get recognized for what I've done. And not because I want to walk around asking people to give me credit, but because I want them to believe me when I say I've got something cool that I'm working on. Also, I come certified is the idea, you know, that's all I want. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, what I think everyone wants credit for the work that they do. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I would love accolades for the things that I do. But also, I think at the same time, it is so difficult to have a portfolio where the things that people would recognize the most, you can't share. Yeah. And this is why when I very first started doing cartography, where everyone's like, oh, my God, you should go out and you know, work for Wizards of the Coast. And I was like, I don't want to work for any company. I want to be a freelancer. And I know that for the most part, a lot of people, like, what? Why wouldn't you want a steady paycheck? Because I don't want to be restricted. So many of these companies absolutely do that. And your contracts with them are really...
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to disappear behind some kind of name. And maybe that's, you know, all. Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, that's part of that is ego. Part of that is, I don't know. I made, when I was in college, my senior year of college, I made a little 3D, you know, little CG animated movie that was about 4.5 minutes long. And that was part of my like senior thesis. And I had my roommate's father, who was a writer, you know, he came to watch his son graduate and they went to the art show and he saw my movie and he said, you know, you have a real, you know, it was a silly movie. It was a ridiculous movie about some funny looking aliens who meet in an Egyptian temple at night to play dice and end up waking up a mummy.
Oh, no.
And so it was totally ridiculous. But he, you know, saw that and he said, you know, you have a real, I can tell you have a passion and a gift kind of for storytelling. You know, don't spend your life bringing other people's dreams to life. Bring your own dreams to life. And at the time, I thought that was a really lovely thing to say. But at the same time, I was like, well, you know, Mr. Jasperson, I just need a job.
Right.
And so when I did get a job, you know, in the game industry at Bethesda, I could not have been more thrilled. And I think there's a huge argument to be made for, especially early in your career, having structure, having somebody else help you produce, and maybe giving you assignments you don't want to take, because all that stuff kind of can push you in some unexpected ways that really can make you grow. I think, and I think also getting used to a production environment can be really, really helpful to a young individual, because I think one of the critical elements of creating art and creating worlds and all these things is discipline and being able to just start and finish any given project and just do that again and again and again and again, instead of floating around aimlessly or not quite finishing projects or taking too long to finish them, etc. And so that was really helpful. But within a few years of being at Bethesda, I could feel my heart drifting, not drifting away, but drifting on, you know, being interested in doing other things and telling it my own story. And so just a couple years into working there, that's when I started working on what would become my fantasy novel, my unpublished fantasy novel. Right. And it really gave me a respite from the kind of dictated, you shall do this, you know, every day in, day out kind of thing. And it was such a gift, honestly, you know, a place where I could go in my mind that belonged to me entirely. I'm so grateful that he had this conversation with me all those years ago, because it was such a simple thing to say. It was just basically like a, you know, a one sentence thing he said, and it's nothing particularly revelatory about it, but the fact that he said it meant that a couple of years later I followed through, you know, right. and did what he suggested. It did really, you know, ultimately you can argue that that led me to where I am today, you know, a glorious broke artist living in New York. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, living the dream, right? You know,
totally. Yeah. No. Things. I'm very grateful for where I'm at, to be honest with right. you. And I'm living in a space of great unknown at the moment, because I've put so much time and effort into this project that I'll be kickstarting, but I obviously have not kickstarted it yet, and thus I am, it's a period of great uncertainty. But yeah. What a privilege and what an exciting moment to be able to find myself in, you know, just to be able to do that in the first place and have some hope that maybe people will lift me up and make it a worthwhile endeavor.
Well, I say it all the time. My worst day doing this beats my best day not doing this. Mm,
I like that. Yeah, I definitely think that working in that production environment really helped to sharpen a lot of my skill sets, and it helped to kind of expand my knowledge base. It provided me like the discipline and structure that I needed to kind of create and be kind of mindful of what's needed to really create something and how much of it is needed and how long things realistically take. Not that I do a good job still of guessing how much time it takes for me to do any given one thing, because I still get that wrong all the time. But I give myself way too much credit when it comes to scheduling, and then I always screw myself.
I'm the opposite. I tell everybody I tack on a week or two for everything that I make and be like, bye, I'll probably get it done in 3 days, but I'm going to tell you it'll take me 3 weeks, because if I don't, it will take me 3 weeks.
That's great. That's a really smart way to do it, though. I wish I did that way.
Well, now that you know, you can just tack on a day, just double whatever you think it'll be easily. When it was possible to hire me within a week's notice, now you need 6 to 8 months to hire me.
Not bad.
Yeah. No, well, some of that now is finally my personal project. This year is the first year that I have no specific commercial work lined up.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So I have a bunch of projects that I'm just absolutely dying to do. I'm also trying to make sure I don't get completely burnt out, because at one point I was churning out maps and projects, and I'm like, I don't want to not do this. I love creating other people's or mapping other people's imaginations, so to speak. So I want to keep doing it, just not at a breakneck pace.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So I last year, it took me most of the year of turning down new work for me to be able to finally have, like, I have some projects lined up. They're not like it normally is, and I don't feel like I'm gonna burn out in no time. But I mean, I've also been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah, you've been, for as long as I can remember, you've been doing this.
Yeah. So yeah, I've been with Critical Role for six years. God damn it.
I bet it's closer to six. I feel like you started with them a while ago.
It was 2018. February 1st, 2018 was the first time one of my maps went.
There you go.
Dream, 6 years ago. Because it was my birthday. Yeah.
Oh, happy belated. Or happy, sorry. I was a little late, but happy belated.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, you're really early.
Yeah, that's right. You heard it here first. I wished you a happy birthday first.
You're the first person to do it for this year. Thank you.
Yeah, you're totally welcome.
I have to ask how, like, so I know that if you're doing this for Bethesda, Like, it's obviously, it's you and a team. What does it look like when you're doing it just for yourself?
Yeah, it's tricky. Well, it definitely depends on the project that I'm working on. So because I don't really do 3D for games much anymore, you know, I still have ZBrush and I still have Marmosets and things like this. And I have Substance Painter, but I just, you know, I haven't worked in Substance Painter in any kind of real way in a couple years, at least, beyond like kind of polishing up old models for my online portfolio, etc. And so I don't use 3D software really as much as I used to. And these days, it's really come down to, I have a computer setup that has a Wacom, you know, a Wacom Cintiq monitor, which is at this point, gosh, 12, 13 years old. I definitely need to replace it, but can't quite justify the expense yet. And I've been doing a lot of work on the iPad in Procreate, which I really appreciate because it's kind of like almost like a low tech solution in that it's not a very complicated program. It's very easy. It's very simple. And, you know, it's one of those programs that can't do a million things. It can do a couple things really well. And I really actually find a lot of freedom in embracing programs that can do just a couple things really well, because it keeps me more focused and it keeps me kind of productive. And so when I did all of the drawing from Marvel Anatomy on the iPad in Procreate using like an iPencil and everything, and then I did all of the painting for Marvel Anatomy, so all the colors and shading, I did that in Photoshop on my Cintiq. And on this comic project, Quiet Level One, I have spent an even more of my daily time working in Procreate, and actually very little time working in Photoshop. I'm sure I'll move over in the later stages when I actually have to kind of line up things on grids and make sure that the writing is where it needs to be and create subtle gradients and things like that, which I think will really help to make the comic pop. But the act of drawing is simply more pleasurable when on a when in Procreate than when in Photoshop. I find Photoshop's drawing software, and maybe my hardware is also to blame here, but I just don't find it that impressive. And so it's really great for me for painting, but not so much for the drawing, the line work. So yeah, I'm doing a lot of that. That's kind of my pipeline right now. So I just spent a lot of time. I got a little iPad stand so that I'm not hunched over it all the time. And I spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, I started drawing in Photoshop because I didn't know how to. So I also have a Wacom tablet. The reason I didn't create digitally is because I'm visually impaired.
Okay.
And a lot of the surfaces that you normally would draw on, because I can't do the look at something that's not my hand drawing. So I can't draw with a mouse or draw on a tablet and not be looking at my hand at the same time. I have no idea how people have that eye-hand coordination. That's impressive to me.
To do what?
I can't do the how somebody can look at a monitor and then draw on a tablet and not be looking at their hand.
Oh yeah, it's pretty hard. Yeah.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. but a lot of the tablet surfaces were impossible for me to draw on and be able to see with my visual impairment.
I see.
So when I got the we have a Wacom center here in Portland, and I got to test it out, and I immediately knew I'd be able to draw on it. And I used Photoshop because it was the only thing I had at the time, and I drew exactly as I did on paper. I realized that I really don't like Photoshop. For anyone who uses it, hey, more power to you. But me personally, it is, being that I did so much traditional art beforehand, there are so many things about it that it feels more, because it is made for photography. And being that I did photography for years before that, that's what I knew. So that's why I used it. And then I had I tried Clip Studio Paint, and that was it. I immediately stopped my subscription to Photoshop and removed it off my computer.
Wow, you made the move.
Oh yeah, I I can't stand Photoshop's. I can't stand Adobe's subscription service the way it is.
I don't like it either. Yeah.
Yeah. It is ridiculously expensive and it just feels like it prices out beginning artists. But also for what you're paying, I don't feel that it measures up.
I agree.
Yeah. So I love Clip Studio Paint. It works far better. It is basically made by artists for artists. So it has all the wonderful little nuances that I really enjoy and make it a lot easier. So now I do everything digitally, which is just fantastic. I love it.
That's great. Yeah, I do. I do almost everything digitally. I worked traditional for a couple years ago and learned so much and did so many cool things in that like year and a half that I worked traditional. But ultimately, you can't do a lot with traditional art.
No,
because it's not easily distributed, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I used to have to scan my maps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
exactly.
Yeah. Scanned artwork never looks as good.
Definitely not.
Yeah. So I completely understand. But also, you know, the other thing is like it, although the only thing I do miss is having the original pieces, but part of that is because I used to do painting and I'm so used to like selling your paintings. So you sell the originals and my brain's like, I need to get out of that mindset because it doesn't work that way anymore, or it shouldn't for what I do. Are you working in a shared space or do you work from home?
Yeah, I have a little studio that I walk to every day, 15 minutes away. It's really nice. It's a kind of a building kind of meant for creatives. So painters, ceramicists, that kind of thing. And I am in there, and I started working here a couple years ago. So I have, but the office space here in New York is expensive, and so I'm sharing it with a guy. He's a really, really great guy, and it's working out pretty well.
Do you mind if I talk about that? Because I think that is it's interesting how many artists actually go to like a cafe or go someplace other than their home to work.
Yeah.
And when I talk about it, I was like, oh, well, you know, you should like rent some office space. I don't think, I think that people have such a very different idea of what that is or looks like or how expensive it is or isn't, that I think that, especially as a New Yorker, because this is a very typical thing for us to do, is rent an office space somewhere.
Well, we don't have a lot of space, you know, physically otherwise in our apartments and everything.
Right. I mean, I had an apartment that I shared with five people at one point because New York rent is, well, it's New York rent. And
yeah, pretty crushing. It's pretty crushing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you don't mind, you don't have to tell me any like specific prices or anything else because it will be different for everyone who's in different areas, but going to a different place, do you feel like even if you're not making the money at the moment to pay for it, do you feel that it's still worth it because it pulls you away from where you are? Would you, if you had a bigger place, would you prefer working at home? Or do you feel that this gives you the more structure to actually focus and work and not be distracted by things at your house? Or
yeah, good question. So I definitely, I worked from home for many years. And then when I moved up here to New York, and then when my daughter, shortly before my daughter was born, you know, we only had so much space, so I had to move out, or I didn't have to move out, but I had to move out my home office to make way for the baby. And so I found a place, wasn't so nearby, it wasn't that nice either, but I will tell you, I did that, and then 9 months later, the pandemic hit. And so being able to leave my house where we were cooped up in and go somewhere else to do work just alone was really nice, even if it was not so kind of close. And so I find it really, really pleasant to be able to leave and come to a place where basically my work brain turns on and my home life turns off. And then when I do the reverse commute and go home, I'm done working, you know, unless I take my iPad home and I'm ready to work in the office after dinner. But basically, it does help to really partition my life into work and living. And while I hate how much it costs, and it's not all that sustainable, you know, I also don't unfortunately have a choice. But right. But it is, if I had my druthers and I had the funds to just keep doing this, I would just keep doing this, because it is very nice to be able to actually take a break from work and go home and vice versa.
Oh yeah, because we wouldn't otherwise. Like the only reason I do is because, one, I am a gamer and I obsess with playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I make sure that I have like, it's the end of my work day and that's it. And I will absolutely immediately want to jump into games. So it's a little bit easier for me.
Yeah, that's one thing I haven't been able to do, actually. I've had to give it up. not games entirely, but the idea of finishing games and then continuing to work, continuing to play directly afterwards. Because yeah, I used to be like you. That was my exact escape. The moment the workday was over, I'd fire up and play for an hour and a half of whatever addiction I had at that time. And my addictions certainly do not go away at all. I still love games just as much as ever. But now I have to go home, and I can't, and I don't have a computer at home, and so it's not ideal for my video game playing world. But that's where we're at. Yeah,
I have a room to myself. I have my home office, and it's completely separate from the rest of the house. Like, I absolutely feel that if you want to work from home and be productive, is to set yourself some really, really specific boundaries. Like, this is my space. This is my workspace. This is my work hours. You know, it's kind of like how they talked at one point, like, oh, if you want to feel like you're going to be at the job, then every day when you get up, put on business attire. And I'm like, that doesn't fucking work. Like, what a dumb suggestion, but okay, sure. I mean, I'm sure it works for some people, but for the majority of people, it's not going to. Like, it really is finding where, one, what you're distracted by the most. Like, what makes it easiest for you to, like, be away from doing the work that you want to progress with. But I tell everyone, don't set a clock. Don't go, oh, I work from 9 to 5, because no artist I've ever known does that, unless they do actually go someplace to work. Whether it's for a company or like you, has a specific office that they go to and it's not in their home.
Yeah, it's really helpful. It's really helpful to have some kind of partition. I think I could, now that I've been doing it for a while, I think I could probably go back to a home office if I have the space, but it would really have to be in a different part of the house. It would have to be a place where I would even honestly even think about having like a tiny little fridge or something in that room so that we don't have... So that I like don't have an excuse to leave.
Right. Oh yeah. So basically what we do with mine is everything in my office is so I don't have to leave unless I want to or need to, you know, like go to the bathroom. I don't have a toilet in here, unfortunately. so that much I'd have to leave for, but otherwise I don't. We make it so it's as quiet or, you know, as possible. I usually work with headphones on anyhow, but it's just so I don't have distracting things in the background. But the place that we moved to recently, we have 2 floors and then a basement. So my wife decided to take over the basement and then realized she has to move away from the area that she originally wanted because it's directly under my office.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, you know. And the other thing is, like, I set myself every day when I go to start a project, I decide that I need to get to a certain point in that project for me to feel like I've done a full day's work. And that's my quote unquote hours that I choose. And usually I'm at least now I'm a lot better at deciding like, oh yeah, no, I'm pretty good at figuring out like how long I can draw in a day. And like, okay, I need to get to this point in the project for me to feel like I've done the work for the day. And I don't stop until I get to that point. And it's usually pretty good now. When I started, I was way the fuck off. But it made it a lot better because I knew at that point, like, I could structure a day of work. And again, the hardest thing to being a freelance artist is, one, making yourself actually be productive. And two is learning how to put your name out there and not feel like you're annoying people.
Yeah, that's true. The self-promotion is a tricky. That's a really tricky.
Yeah. And if you can get past those two big hurdles, everything else seems relatively easy. Relatively.
Yeah. I hesitated there. I was like, does it?
Well, I mean, like those are the two hardest things though, right? Yeah. Like after that, it kind of feels like, especially if you can figure out how to get your project structured and your day structured so you can actually be productive. That helps you with one, putting stuff out there because you actually have things to put out there. You know, it helps you actually talk about it. It helps you talk about your day. It helps you do things like Patreon or anything else where you're putting out things on a regular basis. Your production works best that way. And that's one of the reasons why we do have like a hustle culture as we do, which is horrible. But if we can learn to sort of curb that to a reasonable amount of work every day and still be productive while still having, you know, not working ourselves to death, you know, that's the hardest thing that I think a lot of us have to deal with. And it's what causes burnout so quickly is how many people just constantly work from the moment they wake up till they go to sleep because they think that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard. I think that one thing I've gotten pretty good at in life in the last couple of years is achieving a bit of a better work-life balance. But what that means is I'm not hitting the deadlines that I want to hit, and I'm holding myself to a standard of working all the time. And there's really just not that much time in a day to do all the things you need to do. And you have to figure out a healthy chunk of time that is actually doable, and then just do your best to like get there every day, and just recognize that, you know, to build something you have to have patience and you have to just do it bite after bite after bite.
And you know, the other thing is honing your, so I hate the expression like paying your dues, because I think that that's a really weird concept of like, I don't know why. If for whatever reason, in a lot of industries, everyone thinks that you have to pay your dues in order for you to be recognized, or the opposite, which is other people think that you have to pay your dues in order for you to get a job. But we don't, you don't have to. Like, there's the only person that holds you to that is you.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So it's important to realize, like, if you're causing a lot of your own stress by making unrealistic deadlines, by not tacking on a week to a project scope, or, you know, or giving yourself ample time to do something. And I think the hard thing is because we don't realize that we should be tracking particular things in order to realize like how long something takes us.
Yeah, I don't do enough of that, honestly. Yeah, I think that's a lot to be said for that. I think you can work a lot more efficiently, a lot smarter if you do that. And I've been doing my best recently to try to take responsibility.
Well, there's great apps that we can use now that like allow you to monitor your time, where you literally just hit a button on your phone, and you start drawing. And every time that you pause or stop, you can click the button to pause the timer and it'll tell you how long it actually takes you.
Yeah. What do you use for that?
Well, I no longer do, but I used to actually just use the stopwatch on my phone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do that to make sure that I get up and stretch periodically. Right. You know, I'll set it for like 20 minutes and then I'll just get up and stretch. Not a long stretch, but just get up and just move my body around a little bit.
Yes.
And it helps. Yeah.
Yeah. But I used to, now that I've gotten to the habit of it, I kind of like have a really good idea of one. I know my body loves to tell me like, hey, you've been sitting still too long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So that does it for me, but I've also gotten to the habit of like, I will work about 45 minutes and then I get up and stretch, move around, and then go back to work and everything else. But also, I've gotten really good at telling how long a project will take me, which I wouldn't have. I mean, I was so bad in the beginning trying to figure out how long something would take.
Me too, man. Me too.
Oh, I underpriced myself horrifically. I had a project that took me almost a month, and I maybe priced it out at like $500.
Yeah, I've done that before. It yeah. is rough. It is rough. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't care who you're working with. If they can take advantage of it or they don't know how much
Yeah, they might not know. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's not them particularly being evil or anything. They just may not know how long it actually takes you or what the standard is for paying. You know, it's kind of, I just had a friend ask me, like, how much do you charge for your maps? And I was like, you can't ask for that. Like, this sounds really kind of mean in a way for artists that are starting off. But unfortunately, when you are first starting, you can't ask for top prices. And it's not because, you know, you'll never get paid that. But it's because if you don't have a portfolio and you don't have anything behind you that can prove you can do the work, people will shop around. And unfortunately, you have to give them a lower price. And I wish it wasn't that way, because I would love it if everyone got living wages for everything they did.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, and the other thing is, when you actually get to the point where you are turning away work, please raise your prices. I don't care if it's more than you are, you know, per hour than you ever thought you'd make. Please raise your prices. Do it for yourself. Do it for your workload. Do it for the ability to raise prices across our industry, so other people can get closer to a living wage.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important, and it's hard to do that. It's really hard to like say like I am worth it, or like this thing is worth it, because like it's hard to justify that. I think, especially if it's your own work, because you know no one's a bigger critic of your own work than you, and so you're offering something that you know is imperfect and you know is whatever, and you're like, well, nobody, this is crazy. Nobody's going to pay for that, and you know what? A lot of people won't pay for that, but some people will. And that's who you need to be relying on, because they're the ones who are going to actually be able to pay your bills.
Right. And here's what I tell everyone. So it costs, if you want to hire me to make a world map, it's $4,000. Mm-hmm. If you can't afford that, and I tell this to everybody who's, especially if it's a project I really want to work on, I will tell them like, hey, if this doesn't fit your budget, tell me, because I do want to work on this project with you.
Yeah.
Tell me what you can afford. And if it's something that is feasible for the work that we want done, then we'll do it. I don't care. I'll give you a reduced price.
Right. You can tailor the scope of what you're doing to that budget. Yeah. Like I can do the exact same thing you're asking for, just a little simpler and with a little less detail, that kind of thing.
Right. You know, or I can sell the prints, or like I can work out something where I make the money a different way, you know, or further down, or maybe work in payments if the project takes off, you know, like there's so many ways that you can work around it. And I think that we're so afraid to say a larger number because it's one, we want the work, and two, we want, you know, especially if we want to work with a specific company, we'll lowball ourselves.
Oh yeah, I know. I've been,
Yeah. And the problem with that is normally a lot of these companies can afford to pay us.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but we're so afraid of like, oh, we'll lose the work. But here's the thing, though. You won't necessarily get the job even if you do give a lower price. And if someone is coming to you specifically, they already like your work.
Yeah.
Give them a number that's far more livable for you, even if you can't quite say that big number yet.
And just trust that they'll probably say, or not probably, but they might say like, we can't do that. And then you say, great, what is your budget? You know, and then, you know, they're always good to anchor high, you know, as long as it's in the realm of believability. Yeah.
Yeah. But the question is, now that you've said that, are you going to do it?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. No, I'm trying to be better at that. I think as I move into the realm of creating my own content and creating my own world, I'm much more like aware of the idea of like just making sure that I'm being jealous of my personal time. And when I have personal time, you know, if you want me to do something for you that takes me away from my own projects, you need to make it worth my time. Yeah. Because it's my time, you know, life is long, but it's not that long.
And you know what's so funny? When we first started off doing projects for ourselves or our own projects, we're like, oh, this is not where I'm going to make any money. So that all gets put on the back burner and I'll do these other projects instead. And then once you actually start getting to a certain point in your career, at some point it just flips, where it's like, oh no, I'll make more money doing my own projects, or I'll make something more meaningful doing my own projects than this. So you need to make that worthwhile for me to do this for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's just protecting your own life. Just protect yourself, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh man. But how many, and again, for any artist that is listening, and don't feel bad if you're not there yet, because it's not like this was like overnight for me or from the beginning. Like, I still underprice myself. I still absolutely lowball my prices so I can have particular projects, or because I want to work with some people. But if I know a company can afford it, I don't have a problem asking. But also, like, some projects are just too fucking cool for you to not want to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, the thing that helps me measure whether or not I do something or not is I try to figure out, like, okay, it might not be that worth that much money, but can I do something? Does it lend itself to social media creation? Because right. then that's another form of payment, which is, you know, I don't want to say you should work for exposure, but if you're trying to build up your rep and build up your name, and you think it's very helpful to have that material, that could be worthwhile. And also, you know, try to decide, like, is this something that will further my own goals of being better in this way or that way, you know?
Right.
I think one of the reasons I took the Marvel Anatomy gig, even though it wasn't the best price thing, was because it was very, very, very good content for social media, because it was suddenly, you know, this huge, huge audience for people, for Marvel content.
Right.
But there was nobody creating the kind of content I was creating, and that gave me, like, exclusive, you know, that gave me a unique power in a realm with a lot of potential fans. And I wanted to be really, really good at anatomy and figure drawing. And mm-hmm. so that was like, if I can do a whole book of this stuff, then I will officially have, you know, I'll officially be pretty decent at anatomy. So
Yeah, I just finished a project that it actually took me a couple of years to do, because me and the person that commissioned me for it originally started off as a personal project, and then it just kind of bloomed into this big, huge piece. But it's over 20 maps, basically, and they were all pretty much doing interior work, which I just don't do. And it was really, and it was top-down view, which most of my work is three-quarter. So it was an absolute amazing journey from beginning to end to learn how to draw interiors with the amount of details that I do my landscapes. And it also taught me, one, I absolutely obsess over detail.
No, you? I know.
You know, if you think my landscapes are really detailed, wait till you, if this project ever comes to light, I should say, which I hope it does. It was one of the most detailed works I've ever done. And it was great because they gave me all the time in the world. We literally have been doing it over a couple of years now. They gave me all the time in the world to just sit there and just draw, which I don't really ever get to do.
Right.
And it also helped me learn, like, Clip Studio Paint, and because I started off drawing it in Photoshop, and I was like, well, this sucks, this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also because I couldn't figure out how to, like, I don't know how, and I'm so impressed with so many people that do digital art when they can do it so quickly, because I cannot.
Yeah.
I still draw like it's on paper. So I finally learned with doing this project, like, how to have, like, assets. So even if I want to draw them differently, I can still bring it in and use that as, like, a basic draft, you know, something to kind of, like, give me an idea of, like, the size or shape of something, because I forget, I need reference photos.
Reference is important. Absolutely. Yeah. So, are you talking about, like, mountains and streams and forests and that kind of thing? Like little.
Oh, no, I mean for the interior project that I did.
Oh, got it. Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. You need reference for that. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I wouldn't. And again, my visual impairment makes it so my world is very two-dimensional.
It's based in one eye.
Yes.
Got it. Yep. That makes sense.
So I'm blind in one eye and have a vision in the other. So I end up, a lot of times I go to draw things where I'm like, oh God, I need reference so bad because I can't figure out how to not draw it super flat looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to start this project and I was like, oh God, I actually started almost crying when I first started.
Oh no.
Because it was one of those, like, I really want to do this project, but I can't get it to look right. And I thought I was going to have to turn it down. And but it ended up working out fantastic. And it's now, like I said, it's over 20 different maps. And
it's good. It pushed you, you know, it was like a huge endeavor that like made you a better, stronger and more versatile artist. You know, it was one of those, I'm sure, you know, even if it didn't pay as much as it should have or whatever, it sounded like you got a lot out of it.
Oh, yeah. Honestly, I made the joke that I was like, I started off doing it for free because it was a project with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just, you know, although they kept insisting they were going to pay me, I was like, I don't care. Pay me then. Whatever. Pay me $1 for all I care. I just really, really want to do this. And also because it was... it's from a character perspective that I was so excited to be able to create from. Because when you're doing a map, you're not creating from a character's perspective for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, unless, you know, I mean, you sort of can, because the different types of maps, like whether a merchant created it so it'd be a little bit more fancy, or if it's just a scouting map, or, you know, like you can have different looks to it, but it's not quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
This whole project was from a particular character's point of view, and it was just, I immediately wanted to do it because I've never been able to genuinely draw maps from a character's perspective, and I thought it was amazing. And I was like, I don't care, pay me whatever. I don't give a shit. Now, you know, several years later, but you know. And it was great. I got tons of information on the character's perspective of every bit that they wanted. And I was like, yes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite projects to date. Just saying a lot.
I think being thrown out of your comfort zone can often result in like some of your favorite work, honestly.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made me, I don't think I want to do like interior maps a ton, because again, I am very, very detail focused, but it did make me change how I want to tell stories with maps. I kind of wanted to do that from the beginning. I love telling the history of a world.
Oh yeah, I love that.
Yeah, but it made me change like how I did my cartography course, because originally I made it thinking everyone wanted to ask me how I drew them, not the science behind any of it. And then I realized, like, oh no, you all want to know about like tectonic plates and, you know, and world history. Like, how does this all work? Oh, okay. And then I remade the entire cartography course over this past year to like world build and teach people how to world build from a cartographer's perspective.
Yeah, that's really, especially if you're world building and you want to create places that have never existed before. I think that's really, really critical to be able to take a look at a map. I mean, maps are history, right? Like they are geological history. They are, you know, people's history. You can see like where people might migrate, where an army might create a choke point and make a stand. Mm-hmm. You can see where this, you know, why these people live over here and these people live over here. You can then, you know, based on that geography, you can create local gods and spirits and beliefs. You can figure out what people are wearing in that area based on what's around them, whether it's, you know, woven plant matter, or they have sheep or what have you, or they have, you know, rare spiders that create the most softest of silk.
Yep.
You can just go on and on. And there's so much to cover in that. Like just a map is a story, you know, and it's not necessarily in order, but I think a well-drawn map and a well-thought-out map can tell you so much about the world And it definitely, I think the more well thought out it is, and I know yours is the most well thought out, the more, you know, true geeks and fans can really get things out of it.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the best pieces of lore that you could ever give your fans or followers or readers or whatever, just because it brings that world to life in a way that illustrations don't necessarily do, or articles don't necessarily do, because it, when we see a map, it's something in our real world and it's tangible, it's an actual place. You know, definitely. Everybody has cracked open a book and seen a map and immediately want to know everything about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a glimpse of the whole, it's literally a glimpse of the whole world beforehand. Yeah. I really wanted to do a map for my Kickstarter for this world I'm building. And actually the closer I get to the Kickstarter, the more I realize I don't have time because it's going to really take everything I have to do it. And it's an unusual map too, because my world, it takes place on what's called the Tree of Worlds. And so it's basically a tree that has levels that go up and up and up and up. Because my world, it's kind of a shout out to video games as well as traditional myth. And so it's kind of like a big world tree, like Yggdrasil or something like that. Or Yggdrasil, if that's how you say it.
Yggdrasil.
But it's also levels in a video game. And so each level of this canopy of this world tree is a different realm, you know?
Right.
And basically the idea being that my main character will progress, my main character and the villain will progress up the ladder of levels. And it made me realize part of the reason I couldn't do it is because A, it would be so much time to get all the detail and all everything. But B, it made me realize I have to know my whole story from beginning to end, because the map will tell the story.
Right. Well, not necessarily, by the way.
Yeah, no, not necessarily. But if the end result is to end up at the top of the tree, then I do have to figure out where it ends, at least.
Yes. Yeah.
At least the setting, you know. And so, you know, a lot of the middle, I agree. A lot of the middle, I can make up. I can say this is Marsh World, and this is Snow World, and this is, you know, all these things. But I think I definitely want to be more deliberate about that. And so I just realized, I was like, damn, I don't think I can do this map thing, even though it sounds so fun, because as you say, it's like so inviting and people immediately see it and immediately begin to dream.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And there's, you know, like I tell people all the time, like your map is in the past. It's okay if there's something that's on there that isn't anymore, or something that is there that isn't showing on the map, or it doesn't have to be completed. Because one, if the story isn't completed, why would the map be? Your map isn't made from your perspective. Your map is made from an in-world character perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't stress that enough, because so many DMs that I work with, or so many writers that I work with, think that there needs to be like, oh, well, I need to have everything done and everything fleshed out. I'm like, no, you don't.
Yeah. No, you don't.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think getting the tent poles of what you're going for, you know, what's my beginning, what's my end,
right.
You know, and maybe one point in the middle, that's probably as much as you need. And then you can kind of flesh it in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like even in our real world, we have made maps based on rumor.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
You know, so your map could have been based on rumor, and it can say that at the bottom, according to what we've heard from so-and-so, you know, like, and those things are great. Like, I always think of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
If he made a map, you know that all of that would be like, it would be based on what someone else said, you know.
total hearsay, right. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and that's perfectly plausible. Make your cartographer for whatever story you're writing, make that an actual character. Why would they even know what something looks like? Have they gone there? If they have, or what level are they? And also, as a cartographer myself, there's a lot of adventures that I have. Like, if my first map of Skyrim which was made when I very first started playing the game, looks nothing like the one that I've made a year ago, a few years ago, whatever it was. Last year, who knows? Time is a weird soup.
Especially since the pandemic, yeah.
That I made most recently. They look very different because I've scoured Skyrim numerous times since then.
Yeah, I like that. I like that idea. The idea of having the map kind of be its own unreliable narrator.
Yes.
It's good. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
Smart. It's also a really fun way of doing it and bringing fans along for the ride. They get to explore it with the author of the tale.
I think it would be really cool to have to start a new fantasy novel, maybe about two warring nations, and get two different maps at the beginning. I think that'd be really fun. I don't think I've ever seen that actually. Like in two different maps made by two different authors, you know, like I think it would show, you know, I mean, first of all, where the map is centered is like that's the center of the world. And so whatever country is responsible for that map, they're going to put themselves at the middle. And then kind of just the things that they find important, you know, whether if one culture is locating all the foundries and the iron mines and the castles and all that, you're like, okay, it's a warring, you know, group. And then the other map is full of, you know, hot springs and grazing lands and all these different things. You know, you realize, oh, that's what they hold to be important and to be worthwhile. Right. I have a moment in my fantasy novel, which, you know, nobody will read for years, but there's but there's a moment where you know, two characters who come from very different backgrounds come to an oasis, you know, and one of them says, you know, this is the place that he's been leading the other person to, and the other guy who's kind of works for the government and is kind of a bureaucrat basically, you know, frowns and looks at the map and says, you know, this is called, you know, Odessa Springs on the map, and the other guy who's from the area is like, that's not the name, that's not,
yeah,
you know, it's the, you know, the oasis of the rooted one, you know, that's, you know, people who know, they know, you know. But just this idea that just like, you know, different groups of information prioritize different things, they might name it, give it different names, that kind of thing, I think that can be very enormously telling about any kind of world. And so I think anybody who has done who enjoys world building and who is building their own world should at least sketch their land, you know, and run it through its historical paces. You know, if indeed there was a war, you know, between these two areas here, where would they fight and what would they fight over? Because that's going to, you know, you might find yourself moving things around drastically to accommodate for what actually happened. But it's gonna, you know, people who are paying attention, it's gonna matter.
Oh yeah. And you have seen something similar, because that's actually what goes on with the Critical Role maps.
Oh yeah?
Oh yeah. I've had a couple of people who've paid attention. The Dwendalian Empire map only shows specifically the Dwendalian Empire. Everything else around it is completely faded out, because they don't give a shit about anything outside their borders.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's storytelling right there.
The Jorhassian map has different names on it. There are some quote-unquote spelling mistakes that are not spelling mistakes on the maps. They are different because they are called different in those areas. And that's also why all the maps look different, because Jorhas wasn't united enough to have like a map specifically created for them. They would use more scout maps and everything else, because a lot of people roam around more than they do other than, you know, some of the major cities. Same thing with the Odirian Wilds, was specifically made as a merchant's map, and that's one of the reasons why it's all nice and colorful and shows specifically the valley it does, because there's a lot of export out of that area. So all of the maps kind of have a different look and have some little bits and pieces that kind of tell parts of the story of that area of the world. That's one of the reasons why we should be doing that with all of the maps that we do. Creating a world map makes it a lot harder. We should just be doing it in areas and kind of building off of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, all I want to kind of express to your audience, you know, because your audience are fans and fantasy lovers and world building enthusiasts. I would just say I would love for you to check out my YouTube and my Instagram, because those are two realms in which I try to just convey a lot of learning. I try to basically, you know, I feel very intensely lucky to do what I do for a living, even as hard as it is. And part of the way I try to make myself feel karmically better for living this lifestyle of being able to make fantasy art for a living is I try to pay it forward with delivering as much information and knowledge as I can. So that sometimes takes the form of kind of YouTube videos. Sometimes it's just a post where I reveal on Instagram and where I reveal what I'm working on. And if anyone's interested in my Substack and wants to follow along in my journey of creating Quiet Level One, and in doing so, learn about the process of world building and storytelling and character creation, as well as if they want to learn about anything about comic books, which I am learning in real time because I've never done comics before this, they should check out my Substack. It's called The Tree of Worlds. And so those are the resources that I've tried to kind of make worthwhile, and I would love for people to come check them out.